Let's go.
Oh, no.
Do you
want to
start? I'll let you.
I'm excited and I feel relaxed and I'm ready to party!
Let's say sorry.
You don't need to do that. You don't need to apologize. It's a fucked up female habit. You don't need to be sorry for anything ever.
Can you guess what every woman's worst nightmare is?
I don't have rage issues!
I have nothing to prove to you.
When I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
I say when it comes to stardom and Lauren, there are no accidents.
Hi, Karen Peterson.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Citizen Dame, the podcast where we love movies and we talk about movies all the time. And we're going to talk about some movies that if you have not seen, like, what are you even doing here? I don't go and see them before we talk about them. My name is Lauren Humphreys Brooks, and with me, as always, is Karen Peterson.
Hello.
How are you
we
doing,
do love
Karen?
Movies.
We do.
I'm doing okay. I'm here. And I'm here.
Well, you can't.
I'm ready to talk.
You can't say much more than that. Just like, well, I am here.
Present. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm at this point. I know we talk about this all the time where I'm just so, we're just so fucking exhausted, but I feel like I'm just reaching a point where I don't even know how to function anymore. I need it to be summer so bad.
Well, it's getting there. I mean, it's not, yeah. We haven't quite reached summer yet, but yeah, it's definitely like here in New York, it's definitely getting nicer and everything. Well, finally in that area.
Yeah, and I don't just mean weather-wise, although of that course, would be yeah. nice because I'm tired of the... It was 50 degrees yesterday.
Horrible.
Yeah, like we had an event at my school and we were doing some self-defense stuff. And one of the things we were doing was learning how to properly use pepper spray. And, you know, they decided... Well, we were playing with water ones, not with actual pepper spray.
Oh, but come on. It was like, come on. Yeah. Like, you gotta just like injure people. Come on.
Right?
Just
don't even. Yeah, that sounds fun. Anyway, so, you know, we were playing with those outside for an hour. It was 50 degrees and none of us were prepared. So I was cold the entire rest of the day. And I'm like, yes, we need to thaw out. We need it to be 112. I bring it on. But in addition to that, I just need the semester to be over at my school because I'm just like, I'm so tired. I'm in a leadership role, so I have extra meetings and extra responsibilities, which is fine. I'm happy to take that on. But they still won't give me help in my department. So I'm like, I'm spread so thin. Tonight, there's like this weekend is the school, like is a musical the theater department is doing. And it's one that everybody's been looking forward to for a long time. They're doing Legally Blonde. Ooh. And yeah. And so I'm sure it's going to be really fun. But everyone was like, are you coming this weekend? Are you coming this weekend? And I was just like, I don't want to go back to school on Saturday. But I think that's what I'm doing. So yeah.
Well, there you go. Wow. Yeah.
I'm doing.
I mean, I empathize. I worked for a college for a while, a different capacity, obviously, but you have a lot more responsibility than I ever did. But yeah, there's something about, particularly as you're getting to the end of the semester and it's just like, oh, you could just see it in the distance. Like, oh, I just got to get there. Mm-hmm. And everything is kind of ramping up and you just feel like, oh, can this just be over, please? God.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just counting the days to May 21st. That's graduation. And then we get our 3 days of break time and then it's back in right into summer school. But summer is going to be a lot more chill. So
good.
Yeah. We have about a third of the students enrolled and it's quieter. It's calmer. I'm only going to have I normally have 40 staff, like tutors that are working for me. And in the summer, we're going to have six. So way more manageable. And it's the most self-reliant ones. So yeah.
Well, let's
How are
talk
you?
About I'm good. I'm very good. I'm very glad that that spring is coming finally to New York. It has taken a very long time to get here, but I'm quite pleased by it. We actually have sun and lights and warmth is very slowly rising, and then it's going to get fucking hot and I'm going to be like, oh, that's right.
Yeah.
But let's talk about some films. And
what we
decided to do this time is that it is in fact the anniversary of the Criterion Channel.
Woohoo!
Which we are very excited about. And I think that like anyone who's listened to this podcast for any length of time at this point knows that we love the Criterion Channel. Still miss Filmstruck. Filmstruck was a beautiful thing, but you know, we can't have everything that's nice and wonderful, and because WB hates life and joy and beauty.
All true. And that's even before David Zaslav.
I'm so we don't need to talk about him.
Sorry.
But the Criterion Channel is a wonderful resource, and it has so many fantastic films that the Criterion Collection generally does. And so we decided that we wanted to talk about some of the big, really big, like so big that they are like almost not treated fairly because they're so iconic, films that the Criterion Channel has featured and that the Criterion Collection has featured. So the three films that we're going to talk about today, and I think that we're going to say that we're going to spoil them, because at this point, if you have not seen them, please go and watch them, because these are majorly iconic films. These are very, very kind of essential movies. You know, when we talk about essentials, these are the kinds of films we're talking about. And so the three films we're going to talk about are Citizen Kane, the namesake, our podcast namesake. Seven Samurai from 1954, and The Graduate from 1967. So kind of an interesting spread of very different films, but all of them incredibly iconic and considered to be very, very important. These are films that regularly top lists, that are, you know, often kind of cited as being the major works of cinematic art. And we can talk about whether or not that's fair. You know, obviously we've discussed the issues of the canon before, and one of the problems with the canon is that it badly always needs to be revised. It is particularly focused on white male filmmakers, but male filmmakers in general, and all three of the films that we're talking about today are in fact made by men. But at the same time, there's a reason why these films kind of top lists the way that they do, and they do, I think that we could definitely argue that they do deserve to be up there for a multitude of reasons that isn't just about the quality of the films themselves.
I'm going to jump in really quick just to comment on that, because there have been a few times, especially like on my other podcast, where I'll make comments about movies directed by women or whatever. And I think sometimes it's maybe in the way that I talk about it, I'm not sure, or in the audience that's listening to me talk, I don't know what it is, but sometimes it sounds like I'm basically trying to say that we should only prioritize women directed films over what men give. And I'm not saying that at all. We're not saying that at all. Like, men and women should all be able to make movies, you know? And like for us, when we look at the quintessential films, it's unfortunate that we're not saying like, oh, there should be other films by women in place of The Graduate or Seven Samurai or Citizen Kane. It's that there should be, women should have also been able to make films that are in that same realm. I just wanted to kind of talk that out a little bit.
Yeah, no, exactly. And those films should also be valued, because we've talked about a lot on this podcast about female directors, about women who were making movies, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that there's this attitude, particularly in a lot of critical culture and film culture right now, that it's some kind of a zero sum game, that if you swap, that you have to swap out movies, right? It's like, no. It's not about narrowing the canon. It's about expanding it. It's about saying that, like, so we have spent so long with the canon as being primarily focused on men, and especially on white men, right? Mm-hmm. And really, really prizing those filmmakers. It's not saying they are not great filmmakers. They are. But there are other people who are making films at the same time and who deserve the same kind of attention that those filmmakers have received. So You know, it was Elaine May's birthday not that long ago, and there were a lot of people, like, you know, posting about her and everything. And it brought me back to that whole thing with Mikey and Nikki. And one of the things that we talked about when we were discussing that film was, this is a film that should be talked about at the same time as films like Taxi Driver and The Godfather. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's not saying that Taxi Driver and The Godfather are not great films. They are. But so is Mikey and Nikki. And that is what we're kind of talking about in terms of redressing the attention that is being given to female filmmakers, non-white men, et cetera, is to, like, say, we should be talking about Taxi Driver. We should also be talking about Mikey and Nikki. So it's both. Yes. And not either or.
Exactly. Yeah. I just wanted us to clarify that point, because I don't want to perpetuate this myth that we are hating on male directors.
Most of my favorite directors are men. I gotta admit that. Like, you know, if you say to me, if you say, okay, who do you think are, like, the greatest filmmakers that you just absolutely love? A lot of them are going to be men. A number of them are going to be white men, to be honest. I mean, Alfred Hitchcock's my favorite filmmaker, period. There's no one that, like, exceeds Hitchcock for me. But that's very much not saying that Dorothy Arzner doesn't deserve attention.
Exactly. And that's also not just because, well, that's all that's available for these movies too. It's like, they have also made really exceptionally great films, you know, like Psycho, directed by Ida Lupino, would have been a very different movie.
That sounds fascinating, actually.
Actually does, now that I said it out loud.
I want to see Psycho directed by Ida Lupino. Interesting. It would be a very different film. It would not look the same at all, which is okay. It shouldn't.
Right.
But so let's talk about these great films. And again, I think that's one of the things with these particular films, and a lot of the ones that kind of get placed at the top of lists, is that there's this sense that they are so, that they're such the pinnacle of cinema that you almost can't talk about them, that it's they're symbolic almost rather than actual works of art. And people talk about, like, oh, Citizen Kane. Yeah, Citizen Kane is one of the greatest films ever made. Okay, but why? Like, what makes it so great? And I think that that's something we should talk about today in addressing these three films. So let's talk about Citizen Kane. This was a film that was released in 1941, directed, produced, and starring Orson Welles, with a screenplay by Welles and Herman J. Mankiewicz, which was made into the discussion of that was made into a film, which we did not like.
I liked it a little more than you did.
I really did not like it. But so this, you know, kind of tops the lists, as often as the greatest film ever made. And that's always, you know, a questionable kind of title, but it is definitely a spectacular work of art, and particularly groundbreaking for 1941. I mean, just the structure of the film and the way that Welles uses the camera, the use of deep focus, the use of lighting, everything is really fantastic and very unique. It is, you can't find a film that looks and behaves the way that Citizen Kane does. And I think that that's one of the reasons why it's considered to be such a pinnacle. It's so unusual, really.
Yeah. So every year when the Oscars come around and, you know, people freak out about certain movies getting nominated or not getting nominated, getting snubbed, which is a way overused word. And then the movies that do and do not win. And we've taken to kind of teasing people that, like, here's the list of movies that are going to be lost to history because they weren't nominated for Academy Awards. And one of the films that I look to as a perfect example of how the Oscars can really help a film in a year, but don't determine the longevity of it. One of the perfect examples of that is Citizen Kane. It was nominated for 9 Academy Awards. It won for Best Screenplay, but, like, what won Best Picture that year? 1941, do you remember?
I don't.
It was How Green Was My Valley.
Oh, really? That's a great film, too.
Which is a great film. It's a fantastic film. But it wasn't Best Picture. I mean, it was. It won Best Picture. Citizen Kane didn't. Here are the nominees for Outstanding Motion Picture that year. Blossoms in the Dust, Citizen Kane, Here Comes Mr. Jordan, Hold Back the Dawn, How Green Was My Valley, The Little Foxes, The Maltese Falcon, One Foot in Heaven, Sergeant York, and Suspicion. There are a couple of great films in there that I love. Yeah. There are others that I'm like, I've never seen that, and I don't even know if it's available. Like, I think some of these might be even lost films at this point. But that's the thing, is like, Citizen Kane did not win Best Picture, and yet it is considered one of the greatest American films ever mm-hmm. made. And so when your movie doesn't win Best Picture, folks, calm down. It doesn't mean people are going to forget about it in 50 or 60 or 70 years.
Well, and it took a very long time, actually, for Citizen Kane yeah. to start being valued. So it really, generally, Andre Bazin and the kind of Carrière de Cinéma group are sort of the ones who are kind of credited with bringing Citizen Kane back to the public attention. And so that was in 1956. So this is a film made in 1941, right? Mm-hmm. So it takes 15 years for it to kind of be reevaluated and looked at again. It was a critical success, but it wasn't a box office success. It is a remarkable film. Like, this is one time that I actually agree with the French critics. So it doesn't come back as like this major focal point for years, literally. And that's true for a lot of the films that wind up topping lists. You know, we've talked about our issues with Vertigo before, but that's another one that like was not successful when it came out. It was not it was a failure. It was a box office failure. And then at some point, people began reevaluating it and looking at it again, a lot of the time via the French critics. And they were like, oh, actually, maybe this is greater than we think it is. In the case of Vertigo, no, you're wrong. But in the case of Citizen Kane, I think definitely. And one of the things that is remarkable about this film is that it is groundbreaking. It is so unusual. The structure of the film is unusual. The lack of major stars at that time, and of course they became major stars, many of them, but at the time it was not like these were not major players in film. Someone like Orson Welles, who's 25 years old when he makes this movie,
just unreal to me.
It's such an assured film. Like, it is so, he is, we were talking about this on our Slack when we were watching it, the assurance of his camera and of his lighting and of the performances of his actors, his own performance, all of them, it's just perfectly attuned. You're like, this is someone who has not directed a motion picture before. And he's a kid, like he's 25 years old, and is actually managing to put something together that is so mature and so remarkable in what it accomplishes. So where do we want to start? What are your feelings about Citizen Kane, Karen, as a film?
You know, I'm trying to think how to say this. So Citizen Kane is a film that this is an example of a film that really benefits from understanding film history. And the reason I say that is because I first watched it, probably in my very early 20s, maybe like when I was in college, and I didn't really understand much. I knew what the movie was supposed to be about, and I, you know, by that point I had already been to Hearst Castle. I knew a lot about William Randolph Hearst, who this is definitely not about. Absolutely no like all coincidence completely, but
totally
anyway. But so it's like I had a little bit of that background, but I didn't really understand a lot about Hollywood. I think this was probably the first Orson Welles film I would say definitely this was the first Orson Welles film I'd ever seen. And so I just didn't have a lot of understanding or depth to bring into it when I watched the first time. And I actually thought it was kind of boring. And I was just, I was very, why is this considered one of the greatest movies ever? Because at that time I was obsessed with, I mean, still kind of am, but not to your degree, but I was obsessed with Hitchcock, and I was obsessed with, like, I don't know, Coppola and, you know, people like that. And so to watch Citizen Kane, which is a much different paced film, it was kind of boring to me. And as I got older, as I understood the world a little bit better, as I understood film a little bit better and history and what was happening at the time that this movie was made, as I have watched it again and again, it's just grown better and better for me over the years. Mm-hmm. And to the point where I watched it again yesterday and I was like, man, this movie fucking is amazing. It really is one of the best movies ever made. And that's something that 20 years ago, I wouldn't have said.
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago, I questioned that, you know, so I think that this is a movie that definitely ages well.
There's a maturity to it, I think. Yeah. And it is a complicated film in a lot of ways in terms of what it asks of the viewer. And one of the things that, you know, it has been a long time since I actually sat down and watched Citizen Kane, and rewatching it, it's like, oh, I completely forgot that this is what the film did. But one of the things that, you know, immediately struck me was like, they tell you the story at the beginning of the movie. Like you mm-hmm. get the opening with Xanadu and Kane's death and Rosebud, right? And then we get the news on the march. And what we get is a synopsis of the film. This is the story of Charles Foster Kane. Here's what happened. And mm-hmm. and it's very basic. It's because it's a news broadcast, right? And then it turns into...
Yeah, they tell you about his marriages.
We get mm-hmm. every single beat. We meet most of the major characters throughout. And then it turns into this like group of very shadowy group of people whose faces we never really see. Talking about, you know, how are we going to sell this? We need to find out what the meaning of Charles Foster Kane really was. And so then it turns into this investigation, basically, where you have this man going around asking questions of all these different people involved in Kane's life, whom we've already seen or heard talked about, et cetera, in the newsreel, and digging deeper into what the meaning of his life was and what Rosebud meant and that whole thing of like, if we can just figure this out, we'll understand him. And it's so deft because it really does give you the entire plot of the film. Like in terms of just the basic plot, we have the whole story from beginning to end within the first 10 minutes of the movie. And then it sort of says, okay, so this is not a narrative film. It's a character study, right? It is, we're going to dig into who was this person and can you actually piece together this man's psychology, who he was as a human being via these memories of that other people are giving us. What does he mean and how do we access him? It's brilliant. Oh, yeah. Go on.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I find so particularly brilliant about it that is definitely something I did not understand 20 years ago is that we as the audience watching this, by the end, we understand the whole picture of Charles Foster Kane. But the people who are going through this journey and trying to mm-hmm. answer these questions, they never really do. Partly because they're not asking the right questions and partly because some of those answers just aren't available to them. But because we're able to see this experience, like one of his very core memories is what happened to him as a child when his mother signs him away. Mm-hmm. To go live this very rich life, which is what helps him become rich and successful. Because his life goes in this totally different direction. And even when they understand that that is a thing that happens, we're the ones that actually get to see him hearing and experiencing this, hearing his parents talk about it and seeing how he felt about that decision. And so by the end, when they're still trying to answer the question of what does Rosebud mean, that's an answer we got. And we understand that, like, basically for him, no matter what success he had in life, nothing could compare to that feeling of like betrayal that his mm-hmm. own mother gave him away, even though she felt like she was doing what was best for him. But it really, that set up his entire life and really changed affected how he saw himself and how he saw his place in the world.
Yeah. And it's interesting because all of the things that we see, so the way that the camera works and the way that the narrative works is very, again, very deft because we're presented each of these different characters who are ostensibly telling their memories, right, of mm-hmm. Kane. And their relationships with him. We get, you know, we get his friends, we get his ex-wives, one ex-wife. We get kind of, it's interesting because there's this whole thing about like their, you know, his son and wife dying in a car crash. And then we don't actually get anything about that in the film. Right. It's something that you, and you're like, oh, that's going to be one of the answers, right? That's going to be an answer to part of his, of what his psychology is. And we never get that, that it's like, but your kid died. Like, why do we never hear that part of the story? And part of it is because all of the people who are actually involved in that are dead, right? Mm-hmm. Kane is dead. His son is dead. His wife is dead. And so there's no part of the story that can be told from that perspective. But at the same time,
he also certainly would not have talked about his feelings, you know, yeah, in the time period. There's no way he would have talked about his feelings about it.
Yeah. And so it's never public, right? And it is also mm-hmm. never something that is communicated to another character that we actually meet. So we get, right, we have these gaps in the puzzle, as it were, this whole thing about Kane himself being this jigsaw puzzle that we're trying to find the pieces to. And you have only a handful of pieces, really. So you can't see the full picture. And then Rosebud is like supposed to be this key, right? That they're just like, if we could just figure this out, we'll understand him.
Which is true. They just never figure it out.
But it's true, but is it? No, I think that the Rosebud is such an interesting element, because on the one hand, you can be like, yes, we can understand it, but what does it really mean? Right. So it's this word that he spoke when he died. He's holding the glass ball, right? The snow globe that shatters. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously been this attachment to that snow globe, because it comes up in when his second wife, when Susan leaves him. But it is, so it's like this thing that he is anchoring him at some level, or that he's longing for. But what does that actually mean, right? Is it about his mother's betrayal? Is it about the house that the home that he didn't have, you know, the truth of his, you know, childhood? Is this something that, like, oh, the loss of that particular sled just meant something? But we don't know, because that sled could have had major impact in his life for some reason, like that this was something that his father gave him, and then he misses his father. But we have no insight into that, because those pieces are missing.
True, but I think that the snow globe, and then also at the end when they're burning all the stuff that they've decided is worthless in his mm-hmm. house and everything after he's died, and we see them toss this rosebud sled into the fire, so obviously he had that. So to me, I think that he had these pieces of, like, things that really, it wasn't necessarily, mm-hmm. like, to me, it's not the objects. He held on to those because of what they represented, which is the only time in his life that he actually, like, when he goes, when, you know, when you look back on the totality of his life, that is when he actually felt, like, happy and at peace. And then ever since, like, from the moment his mom gave him away, his life just was not the same. And so, mm-hmm. like, I think, like, to me, the understanding of Charles Foster Kane is that he would have traded everything to just have gotten to live the life that he was originally born into. And I think that's why he holds on to the snow globe. That's why he held on to the sled. And that's why Rosebud is the thing that he says on his deathbed. It's because, like, that is traced back to the exact, like, that's what he was doing at the moment that his mom signed him away.
Yeah, and I think that there's a good argument for that. At the same time, it's one thing amid this, like, and we see at the end the just complexity of all of the things that he has, mm-hmm. all of the things that he's stuffed his house full of, that he's never uncrated, yeah. right? Statues and material things that he has never displayed, that he's just bought and sent back and kept buying and sending back. One of the reasons why he has the sled is because he got all of after his mother died, he gets his mother's estate. And, right. and that's mentioned very briefly, but it's like, so all of the things that were a part of that estate are in his house. And that mm-hmm. includes the sled. So somewhere along the way, the sled, that's the other thing. Like, the sled was saved, right? It is.
Yeah.
At some point, like, it wasn't just left out there to rot on the lawn. at some point that was brought back in, but it was stored. It was, you know, this connection that maybe was not sentimental at all for his mother or his father. But that's one of the things, interesting things that I think that the film does, is that we are given these very small number of pieces about who he is. And we have to kind of try to put them together, but we can't completely. I think that that's part of the film's argument, is that you cannot figure out truly who this person was based on these very scant memories. And what's so powerful about that is that this is someone who's consistently in the public eye from the time he's like 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he is rich, he's powerful, he is talked about, he appears in his own newspapers, all that, and no one really knows who he is.
Yeah, everyone knows him, but no one knows him.
Yeah. So it's just a remarkable film. It's one of those ones that, like, we could sit here and talk about it the entire podcast.
Yeah. Well, some of the other, something else that I was thinking about as I was rewatching it was a little bit of just our own obsession with things like, you know, like how these newspaper men, they're so obsessed with his last word. You know, what does it mean? This great man, that his final word must have had some deep, profound meaning. And so that's kind of what sends them on this search to, you know, try to understand him. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it was just the name of his sled. You know, it was just the sled that he had when he was a child. And obviously that's meaningful, but not in the profound way that they're necessarily looking for it. I think about how that relates to kind of our obsession now with things like, oh, we try to derive meaning from so many things that have meaning, but maybe not as, you know, not as big and grand as we sometimes assume that they do.
Exactly. And the viewer, like you said, the viewer is privy to what Rosebud is. What that means is a question, right?
Right.
But we know what Rosebud is, but even if the characters within the film had discovered that, had noticed, right, that the sled is Rosebud, what would they have extrapolated from that?
Right, exactly.
Like, what would they have been able to say, like, oh, now it all makes sense? No, it doesn't make any sense because the viewer has seen certain things, but they haven't. Like you pointed out, they are only hearing pieces of the story. Yeah. So it's very, again, it comes into that power of cinema.
Yeah, well, and also for us, because we do know, we can look at that and say, wow, this man who did so many things, he, you know, he lived this big, grand, very wealthy, extravagant life and did so much for and to people. At the end of the day, when on his deathbed, the last thing he said was a reference to his childhood. And so, so I think it's twofold. I think one is like trying to find this deeper meaning to something, but also, really, when we reach the end of our life, no matter what we've done, what is going to be the thing that's the most important to us? That's kind of the understanding of what your final word is supposed to be.
Yeah.
And for him, it's his childhood. It's that time of his life that he never got to go back to.
Mm-hmm. So it is a great film. I think that I also don't think there's any doubt of that.
Yeah, I just want to take a quick moment to mention, of course, this is not quite the first, but this is very much one of the first Orson Welles films. He had done a couple shorts and he had one other feature before this, but this was basically, Citizen Kane was basically like the movie that made Orson Welles who he was, famous and everything. But it was also the first film of a few other people. Bernard Herrmann, the composer, the amazing, beloved composer. This was his first film, as well as Agnes Moorehead. It was also very early Joseph Cotten performance. So it's one of those things where it's like this incredibly profound and important and quintessential film that was like that just to me, the fact that there are so many people who are basically new to film that were part of this are all part of kind of the miracle that is Citizen Kane. You know, it's like having that many new people on a film that would have this sort of impact is really astounding.
Yeah, it's true. It's amazing to see some of those actors, and they come in and out too. Like, they're not Kane, you know, even Kane is, it's very much an ensemble piece, weirdly enough. You know, Kane is such a focal point, but him as the performer is, he's not on screen all the time. There's a lot of other people moving in and out. And again, it's all of those attempts to really get who he is. So yeah, Citizen Kane, it is definitely not about William Randolph Hearst. And
absolutely not. It's super coincidental.
And but it really is a brilliant film, and one of those that, you know, has been unpacked in so many different ways, and is, you know, I remember it being used to discuss Deep Focus back in film school, and like, because it's just there. It's like, yes, this is exact. This is what we're talking about. We talk about Deep Focus. Here you go, Citizen Kane. Chiaroscuro, like, here you go.
Yeah.
So let's move on to yet another film that I think we could probably talk about for an hour, but we're not going to completely. Seven Samurai. So Seven Samurai is 1954, a Japanese epic samurai film directed by Akira Kurosawa and starring, of course, Toshirô Mifune and Takashi Shimura. And actually, if you've seen any Kurosawa films, pretty much everybody in this one just like, I know that guy. It is, again, one of these quintessential films. And one that is so influential then, of course, on Western filmmaking as well, because it gets readapted as The Magnificent Seven, in a very kind of different milieu, very different approach to the basic story. But it is, again, this is a remarkable film, I think, because this one is fairly straightforward in the sense that, like, it's a classic setup almost. You've got this village that is being menaced by bandits that desperately need help. And a group of men go to look for samurai who will help to protect the village from the bandits. And they find, eventually, they build up this kind of team of seven samurai who are going to come and protect them and train them and teach them how to fight and teach them how to defend themselves. And that's the story. It's a very straightforward story, but it's so complicated. The characterizations and the time that Kurosawa takes in building the relationships, the amount of time that is actually spent on, like, how are we going to defend this village? What is that going to look like? And what does it ultimately mean? The class conflicts, all of it is just so multifaceted and fascinating. This is a 3.5 hour film. And I would argue this is one of those 3.5 hour films that actually needs to be 3.5 hours.
Yeah. Yeah, before we started recording, I was telling you that in my reading up on, like, just trying to understand a little bit more historically about it, the version that they released at the Venice Film Festival in 1953, before it came out wide release in 1954, was actually only 2 hours and 20 minutes. And I can't imagine what they cut out to make that. And it was the international version. I think that the Japanese version always was about 3.5 hours, as best as I can tell. But I guess to appeal to an international audience, they cut down the film. And it was played in the United States as The Magnificent Seven until Magnificent Seven was the remake based on this in 1960. And so then it went back to its original translation of its name, Seven Samurai. But yeah, I cannot imagine what they would have cut out and how that film would have looked at, you know, 1 hour shorter.
A whole hour. That's the thing. Like, but one of the things that I really love about the 3.5 hour cut of this film is how much time is actually spent building up the characters. And not just the samurai themselves, but the characters, the village, the village is a character itself, and the individuals that they interact with, the class issues that are developed, the class conflict that is there, and the amount of time. And also the other thing that I really noticed on this watch was the amount of time that they laugh. There's a lot of laughter. Like they laugh, they joke, they make fun of people, they clown around, they play. And it isn't so, it isn't like this, we are very serious samurai who are going to defend you. It's very like, no, we're gonna, you know, we make fun of each other. We're going to laugh at one another. We're gonna laugh at the fact that this is, you know, we're in, this is a dangerous situation. We're in dire straits, but also you have to smile about it. And I really like that throughout the film, that the film is, because of the way that it's structured and because of its pacing, it gives space for that. And it doesn't make it boring. It's not like, oh, this is something that you can cut out. It's like, no, this is, we need this. We need to feel that sense of community.
Right. Which probably that is some of the stuff that they cut out. And I mean, the film was still well received around the world in 1954. So I guess sacrificing some of that didn't ruin the enjoyment of the film, but it definitely deepens it. For sure. And I think part of why it's, well, probably entirely, well, I don't know. The actors are fantastic, which is a good part of why that is all so much fun to watch and so interesting. But also there was a lot of research that went on with Kurosawa and with Motoki, who is one of the producers and the writers that worked on this film. There was so much research into really understanding the samurai of the 16th century. And from one of the things I was reading about was that all seven of the samurai in this film are based on real samurai. So they found, you know, depictions of and writings about these different individuals and kind of crafted them into these characters. And then also the basic story of these, you know, these samurai being hired to protect villages, that was also historically based too. That was something that was really going on. And I think what we get as a result is this film that I mean, obviously I wasn't there. I don't know what the samurai were like or what it was like to live in feudal Japan with the samurai going around, but like weirdly, I don't know that, but it feels like a film that really is invested in helping us just understand that life, that world, the sacrifices that are made and what goes into the, like just becoming one of these people, one of these protectors, and not just all the good, like they're not turned into superheroes. They're heroes for certain, but they're not superheroes larger than life in all the ways that we know them now. They're fallible. They have flaws. They make mistakes and not always best decisions. But they're also really deeply caring people, and they enjoy each other and they enjoy the people around them. They're kind of that full development of a person, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And the film allows for that. It takes its time. They're almost presented as archetypes to begin with, and then we get the depth of them. So you know, you've got the kind of the older samurai who is, you know, sort of in charge of everything. But then we get more and more about who he is. We get the young kind of acolyte who is trying to find his way in the world and is also wealthy, and then you get the clown, the Toshirô Mifune character, who's like kind of clowning around and he's strange and funny and everything. But we get deeper and deeper into who they actually are without undercutting the archetypes themselves. So it's a really well done balance. And the other thing is that, you know, this is a film that's being made in 1954. And so this is not even... not even 10 years after the end of World War II. And as with so many of Kurosawa's samurai films and Kurosawa's films generally, it's about post-war Japan. And it's about the conflicts of, you know, of the people, right? The farmers, the peasants, et cetera, the warrior class, the meanings behind the meaning behind that, the people who suffer as a result of war and as a result of these conflicts that they're not a part of, but that mm-hmm. are they have to defend themselves from. And there's this wonderful combination of sympathy for the farmers, but then also this whole thing about like the farmers hiding things, hiding their, you know, there's the whole thing about we're gonna hide our daughters from these samurai who are coming in. And on the one hand, you're like, well, that's ridiculous. But then on the other hand, you're like, no, actually that makes sense. Like it does this really interesting balance throughout of the fear between the warrior class and the peasant class. And the fact that no one is particularly excused, you know, there's a wonderful speech that the Mifune character gives about like, you know, they're hiding things from you. They're hiding food. They're hiding, mm-hmm. You know, they're hiding weaponry. Look at the spears and the shields and everything that they have taken from dead soldiers. And they're like, well, we can't fight for them. I hate them now. And it's like, yeah, but you did this to them. Of course they're looting from people. Of course they're hiding things from you because this is exactly what happens in this society. You did it. Maybe not you specifically, but you know, us as a class did it. And so there's this really interesting kind of interplay going on that is very complicated and is not coming down on one side or the other. It's saying like, this is the nature of the society.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, it really is just a remarkable film. And I hope that anyone who has not seen Seven Samurai, if you're daunted by the length of it, I mean, watch it in pieces if you want to. It
has an intermission.
Yeah, exactly. Like almost dead center of the film. Like it is just so, so well done. So remarkable.
Yeah, it is.
And gorgeously photographed. It's just an exciting, intense, funny, just incredibly entertaining film.
Mm-hmm.
So anything else to say about Seven Samurai?
Well, you know, it was remade into a full-on American Western, and then remade again a few years ago, and that was not very good. And The Magnificent Seven from 1960 is a pretty good movie, but what I think is interesting, you know, a lot of people have talked over the years about Kurosawa being really inspired by American Westerns, and you definitely see some of that in this, but it's funny because here the bad guys are the ones with the guns and the mm-hmm. samurai with you know, they have their traditional weapons and traditional fighting and things, and so it's almost like watching a Western from the point of view of the indigenous characters and not from the cowboys as the heroes.
Yeah, this whole thing about the gun versus the sword and getting a hold of guns and taking their guns away is very important because because they can kill you, right? But there's also there's a limit to guns as well, and it's very deftly done. Again, something that comes up in a number of Kurosawa's samurai films is that intersection between the gun and the sword and traditional fighting versus versus more modernized forms of warfare, etc., and how that gets complicated.
Which, as you mentioned, pointed out. Coming just a couple of years after the end of World War II, which was entirely fought with modern warfare weapons. And this is also, sorry, I didn't mention this before, but this is also produced by Toho Studios, which did Godzilla too. So obviously this is a time where Japan is grappling with World War II, with what happened to them, with what they did, you know, with the totality of that war. And so I think taking this 1500s story, this time period, and using that to kind of grapple with some of the modern their modern experiences, I think was a really brilliant choice. It's full of symbolism and full of lessons, I think, that were very relevant in 1954 and are very relevant in 2024.
Yeah, exactly. And you're talking about a traditional society, and part of the conflict within Japan, I know at that time, is this issue of the traditional society fighting a modern war, mm-hmm. but relying very heavily on tradition and hierarchy and issues of honor and shame and things like that. And that's part of what Kurosawa is criticizing, is that this is a society that cannot continue to function in this way, mm-hmm. because it's been outstripped, essentially. You have to fight differently. You have to think differently. You have to change the way that you think, in order to survive, period. So it is a fascinating film. It is available on the Criterion Channel. If you have not seen it, go watch it. If you have seen it, watch it again. So good.
It won 2 Academy Awards, by the way.
As it should have.
Yeah.
So for our final film, this is much less epic in scale, actually, than either one of the previous ones. But we wanted to talk about a slightly different film. This is from 1967. It's The Graduate, starring Dustin Hoffman and Anne Bancroft and Catherine Ross, and directed by Mike Nichols. And this is, again, one of those iconic films that, like, it just has seeped into the culture in so many different ways. But I think this one has been severely misunderstood in a lot of ways, at least in terms of its cult, like, iconic impact. You know, we have the whole Mrs. Robinson thing, et cetera. But this film is much more critical of not just the older generation, but the younger one, too. And much more about, like, you know, people who are lost, everybody who is lost within this society. So what are your thoughts initially, Karen, on The Graduate?
I like The Graduate. I think that I think this is in a very different way from what I was talking about with Citizen Kane. I think this is also a movie that kind of changes based on where you're at in life a little bit. You know, when I saw it when I was younger, I just thought, oh, this is a funny movie and Mrs. Robinson is a scary person and you don't want to mess with the Robinsons, you know, and then it's like got this romantic ending, and now I watch it now as a grown adult and I go, whoa, that ending is not romantic at all. There's so much more to it than that, and just as you said, like, this is a movie about people that are lost. I mean, and that is certainly true for many of the characters in it, but particularly Benjamin.
Mm-hmm.
And Elaine, and in some ways Mrs. Robinson too, and I think it really does such a good job of capturing that feeling of, you know, so you have Benjamin, who has just graduated from college, and I have questions about him because he has just graduated from college, but then he celebrates his 21st birthday, which means he graduated from college at age 20. Like, when did he start? I was really confused about that.
I will say I graduated college at 21. So,
yeah, I mean, I graduated from high school when I was 17. So if I had finished in 4 years, I would have also. But I'm saying he graduated from college when he was 20. If it takes about 4 years, did he start early or did he finish fast?
He may have finished fast. Yeah, he may have finished fast. Though, like, if he'd be on the cusp of kind of maybe 17 when he started college,
mm-hmm.
like, I think that you can make it work out. But the whole point being that he's very young, right? He's
exactly. very
like, yeah. and he's sort of, and they're sort of like, oh, everybody's, you know, it all starts with this party. That is like, oh, we're going to celebrate him. And he's like, I don't know who I am. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Like, and people are talking at him and being like, oh, aren't we proud of you? So what are you going to do next? Like, I don't know. Like, what am I supposed to do?
Right. People have all these expectations, not only that he's got it all figured out at the ripe old age of 20 and almost 21, but that he knows where he's going. He knows what he wants. He knows who he is. And he doesn't have any of that figured out. And he's nervous. He's shy. He's terrified of everything and very afraid of whatever is coming in his life. And so when Mrs. Robinson starts hitting on him, he knows immediately, like, he's smart enough to know what she's doing and what she wants, but he's not comfortable just shutting it down. And maybe part of that is because he doesn't really want to, no matter how much he says he does. Although, I don't know, I have questions about that. But regardless of whether he actually wants to or not, he's not to a point of being comfortable with enough with who he is to just say, this is not going to happen and you need to stop bugging me.
Yeah, he doesn't have that degree of confidence, and he doesn't have that, right, like, again, that understanding of himself. And it all happens very quickly. Like, we're introduced to the character at the beginning of this party, and then almost immediately you go into her, you know, Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me, right? All of that. And so you know who this guy is very, very early, and also how disconnected he is and how uncertain he is. All he wants to do is be left alone for like 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. But it's also this sense of being pulled into, I think, this adult world that the adults themselves don't know what's going on half the time. They're not, mm-hmm. you know, there is that sensation of, like, I think one of the things that makes this film so iconic is that it's very iconic for a generation, but it also speaks to generations generally. That sense of, like, you're supposed to have it all figured out, that feeling like, yeah, I'm supposed to be at a certain place when I'm 20 years old, 21 years old, and not knowing. And so you graduate college, you're like, okay, now what do I do? Like, mm-hmm. what am I supposed to be? Like, who am I? What does this mean? Right. And you've got all of these people around you who are saying in various ways, you should know. And it's like, but I don't. And I think that that's true for most people, that you just think you hit a certain age. You're like, ah, I understand everything now. And that's not the way that it works.
Right.
And I think that the film really expands on that, because the more that you get into, particularly Mrs. Robinson and her experience and this realization that she doesn't know what's going on either. She mm-hmm. is very, much more adult and assured and in control and everything, but she's also not. And she's in this world that the choices that she made when she was 20 years old, have, like, shaped her entire life in not the way that you want it to be shaped. One of the things that I was really struck by in her characterization this time around is that I, like you, you know, watching, it's like, oh, it's a comedy, and you've got, like, this really uncomfortable relationship between this very young man and this older woman who's, like, supposed to be twice his age. We'll talk about that in a minute, but but you get to this point where, like, I was like, I sympathize with Mrs. Robinson, not in, like, the gonna seduce a young man kind of way, but in, like, when you begin to get more insight into her characterization, and it's very much an Anne Bancroft's performance and how she responds to some things and the way that the camera is placed. When they begin talking about, like, you know, oh, how did you meet your husband, which is a simple question, mm-hmm. but you see the change that comes over her, and kind of the whole progress of that scene. If you really pay attention to her and how she is responding, it's this realization of, like, this, the world that she has had to live in is not a good one. And yeah. she has sacrificed and lost her entire youth, and not just her youth, but, like, everything that she might have been, everything that she might have wanted, because she got pregnant when she was 20 years old. And that mm-hmm. then snowballs into this, like, rejection, you know, her saying to him, you're not allowed to date my daughter. You're never allowed to take her out. And he's like, oh, you think it's because I'm not good enough for her? It's like, no, she doesn't want to happen. She doesn't want her daughter to experience what she's experienced. That's right. What's going on right there. And then it snowballs out from that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I find Mrs. Robinson such an interesting character, because it's so easy to dismiss her as a predator type.
Yeah.
Because of the way that she kind of forces herself into this relationship with him. It's not, to her, it's not really a relationship. They're just, you know, they're just getting together once in a while to have sex. And she spends time with him, but he feels kind of trapped in it. You definitely get that. And he has tried to tell her no many times, but she doesn't hear that, or she doesn't accept that, or however you want to look at it. And it's really easy to see her as someone who just doesn't take no for an answer and won't let mm-hmm. him, won't let him have his own agency. But really, for her, I think she, because of her experiences, she doesn't necessarily, how do I describe it? Like, it's not even that she doesn't hear the no, or believe it. It's just that, like, to her, they're like, men want her for sex. That's what they want. Yeah. Obviously, that's what this kid is going to want. And yeah, her experience is definitely, definitely make it so that she's in a situation too where she doesn't really understand what she's doing to Benjamin either.
Yeah, and I do think it's important, you know, you get that whole funny but also very uncomfortable sequence with them, with the Mrs. Robbins and you're trying to seduce me, etc. But then they don't actually sleep together at the end of all of that.
Right.
Like she says, okay, call me, basically. When you ever want to get together, call me. And he does. Right. He winds up taking that step. And it's, there's a lot of humor there that like gets developed in like, especially like her when she shows up at the bar and like he tries to order drinks, like all of those things. It's like he doesn't know what he's doing most of the time. And there's that humor there, but there's also this like, they're both getting something out of it, but it's not clear what it is exactly that they're getting. Because right. it isn't just like her accessing her youth or anything like that, which I think kind of gets, that's what it gets dismissed as. There's something more elemental to it. To a certain degree, she's taking power, right? She's taking a degree of power that she's not had. She's like, this young man, he's attractive. I want him. I'm going to take him. Right. And it is predatory in that sense, but it's predatory in a very sad way because that's not something that she's a, there's obviously this association between sex and taking someone.
Right.
And that this, okay, now this is what we're going to do. And that says a lot about her own experiences. And then, you know, in that sense, also the experiences of women in the 1960s and the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's talk briefly also, let's talk about the ending, first of all.
Yeah, we definitely need to talk about the ending.
The end. So it is not a happy ending.
No.
It is this, it's so good though, because you get this like kinetic kind of like, okay, yes, it's not a good idea for Elaine to get married at this point. This is a bad idea. But at the same time, you're like, but now what, guys? Like, what are you going to do? And there's not an answer. And that's the whole point. It's like, okay, so you've gone through all this excitement, this intensity, this, you know, great romance of like, we're going to bang on the door of the church and say like, no, you can't marry him. It's like, now what?
Yeah. One of the things that I think gets actually overlooked in the discussion about that, and especially when they're sitting on the bus, like he's come in, he's driven all the way from Pasadena up to find this church in Santa Barbara, which I was telling you, by the way, like that road still looks exactly the same when he's going through there's a tunnel. And so I've driven up there so many times. My grandparents retired to that area. And it's like, yeah, it still looks like that now, which is amazing. So it was a little nostalgic for me watching it again yesterday. But anyway, he shows up at the church, he breaks up the wedding. She gleefully runs out the door with him. She's like, yes, I don't want to marry this guy who's handsome, sure, but he's probably boring and probably is not going to give her the life that she really wants. And, you know, she's basically being set up to live exactly the same, you know, same way that her parents and all her friends have lived, you know, and she doesn't want that. And so she's happy to run out the door with him. She's smiling, they're laughing, you know, and then they hop on this bus and they go all the way to the back and they sit down and there's kind of this, like, they're smiling and then they're serious and then they're smiling a little bit like, oh, what did we just do? And then they're serious. And then Benjamin, he's just kind of sitting there. He's looking straight ahead and he has that very similar lost look that he had in the beginning. Like, oh shit, now what? And this is the part that a lot of people don't talk about. Elaine, still smiling, turns to him and she's like excited because he just saved her from this marriage. And she's just like, yay. You know, what next? And then she sees him look like that and not look back at her. Mm-hmm. And that is when she turns around and just has this like, oh shit, what did I just do? Yeah. Look on her face. And I think that's the key to that entire moment, is that she looks at him ready for like, you know, now what, and doesn't get back from him what she's hoping to see. And then that's where she realizes she may be just fucked up too.
I think that that's very, yeah, I think that that's a really good observation. That's not something that I agree with you. That's not something I particularly paid attention to. There's that just, there is that sensation of like there's been this burst of, you know, youthful excitement and mm-hmm. romance and everything, and then it's like, what happens next kind of thing. And that's right. the question that the film has been asking about Ben's life for the entire runtime, and there's not an answer for it. It's like, now what, you know? Mm-hmm. And then you get, you know, Simon and Garfunkel who are running throughout this entire film. but it is that sense of like, you know, what are they going to do? What are they just going to keep on riding the bus forever? Mm-hmm. They can't, you know, at some point they're going to have to, neither one of them has a job. Neither one of them has like anything. So they can't just run away from their families completely. Right. And there is that, and the film just kind of leaves you there, and it leaves them on the bus and is sort of asking like, now what's going to happen next? And it's one of those where like, because of the way the film sets it up, it can't end with, you know, Elaine deciding to go off with the other guy, but it also really is not a great ending for, you know, in terms of a happy ending, as it were, for her and Ben to go off together. It's like, is there a third choice, right? Is there another right. choice that these people can make that is not going to be, that is not just going to be a repetition of their parents' lives, or that is not just going to be like them continuing to be lost?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can't really end up apart, and they can't really end up together. And that's the thing, like what is, like at this point in their lives, though, they haven't lived enough, and they have, like, she hasn't finished school. He's trying to decide what to do about grad school. And so it's like, it's interesting because, you know, this could have been a very, you know, a hopeful ending of, wow, we've got the whole world in front of us. So many things they're still very young. They're still 21 years old, and, you know, the world is their oyster, so to speak. But there's also the reality that her father is a very important and connected person who can fuck up his life and yeah. probably will take the opportunity to do that now. And so it's kind of that it's not a movie that's going to just give us this Hollywood happy ending. It's mm-hmm. a movie that is, you know, what Mike Nichols is doing is giving us more of like a realistic ending of like, yeah, we're young and we're impulsive and we're going to do this big grand thing, but then we're going to quickly realize that sometimes impulsive isn't helpful.
Yeah, there's that moment afterwards. It's like, mm-hmm. oh shit. mm-hmm.
Yes.
So what are we gonna do now? Yeah, it's a brilliant ending, and it's a brilliant film. And I do think it's, again, one of those just like, oh, it's about a young man's affair with an older woman. It's like, that's not really what it's about. It's
not at all.
It's
not
about lost people. And I mean, if you really come down to it.
It's about lost people, and it's about that very confusing time in your very early 20s when you've finished college but your life still hasn't started.
Mm-hmm. Just to mention really quickly about the ages, and a lot of people talk yes. about the ages in this film. It is very confusing. I think that everyone plays their roles really, really well. I believe that Dustin Hoffman is like, maybe not necessarily 21, but I'd be willing to believe that he's like a 20 something kid who is very confused. He's very lost. His body language, everything is just very believable as that. Mm-hmm. And same thing with Anne Bancroft as this older woman. They do her makeup really well, etc. Anne Bancroft's like 5 years older than Dustin Hoffman. she is
Mrs. Robinson was 9 years old when her daughter was born.
Yeah, I think Catherine Ross is like 10 years younger or something like that. And William Daniels, who plays Ben's father, is like 10 years older than him. So it's just like, none of the ages work here. None of them. And I do think that in that case, like if the ages were to actually work, basically, because Anne Bancroft is in her late 30s, I believe, when this film gets made. So she's closer to what the age of Mrs. Robinson would really be. She's supposed to be 20 years older than Ben. And so she's supposed to be like 40 something. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense, right? But Ben is 30. He's like in his 30s.
Yeah.
and that's where, like, so the casting of Dustin Hoffman, which is perfect casting, but at the same time, you're like, none of none of this works. Like, that this, I'm confused.
Numerically, it doesn't work. It only works because the actors really are fantastic. They're so good in their roles. Yeah.
And they age, like, and Bancroft, I think so much of it is like the amount of confidence and like control that Anne Bancroft exudes, and the amount of the shyness and the kind of the way in which he's just so uncertain in Dustin Hoffman's performance, that makes that dynamic believable, even though you've got two actors that are same generation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So
I just wanted to shout out Murray Hamilton, who basically plays the mayor of Jaws in every movie. Oh, I love him. I do. And also, of course, just because I'm a nerd, this was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, and it won directing for Mike Nichols. It was also nominated for Best Picture, Screenplay, Cinematography, and 3 Acting Awards.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
And it does have a great Simon and Garfunkel soundtrack.
It has a fantastic Simon and Garfunkel soundtrack, which I had forgotten until I was watching it, and I was like, oh, there's so much Simon and Garfunkel in this.
I have been singing Sound of Silence for days since watching this movie.
I don't think I've ever actually listened closely to the lyrics of Scarsborough Fair, and I was like, did he just say parsley? What?
parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.
Yeah. I had never listened to that part very carefully.
Oh, there you go. And then, of course, the famous Mrs. Robinson song, which is never actually sung in its entirety.
Nope, it is not.
But is also a great song. So yeah, I think that's going to close us out for this one. I think we've got 3 fantastic films. Both Seven Samurai and The Graduate are on the Criterion Channel. All 3 films are on disc from the Criterion Collection. Really worth watching them a second time, watching them a third time. I think I've seen Seven Samurai like 5 or 6 times now at this point. Really, like, these truly are great films.
I was just saying, on that subject, with Citizen Kane, they released a 4K ultra high definition Criterion disc a year, maybe it was last year, maybe it was the year before. It is beautiful. So if you are a fan of physical media and it's in your budget, save it for, you know, pick it up this July when they do the next Criterion Barnes and Noble sale. It's totally worth it. It's gorgeous.
Awesome. Yes. That is one that I'm going to get, I think. Because it's such an important film. So I think that's going to close us out for this week. And we will be off next week because Karen's got something going on. Also, we're just taking a break from talking about all of the amazing films that we watched. And yes, of course, life
is going on.
And of course, we would like to thank our lovely and wonderful patrons, who include Abby, Ali, Brian, Connor, Estefania, Heather, James, Judy, Carriata, Matt, Michelle, Monty, Nanina, Robert, Steve, Sharon, and Tao. Thank you so much for continuing to support us, guys. And if you want to be a member of our Patreon, that's patreon.com/citizendame, and you get fun stuff as well as access to bonus episodes and access to episodes early. We should be doing another bonus episode before long. We've been talking about it, so I think we're gonna get some more out to you pretty soon. You could also go to our Etsy store. That's etsy.com/shop/citizendamepod. And we do have a Ko-Fi, ko-fi.com/citizendame. And of course, we have our website, citizendamepod.com, where we've got reviews and editorials and fun stuff going on there. And you can also get in touch with us. Our email is citizendamepod@gmail.com. You can also, please, for patrons, if you want to leave comments on our Patreon, like, please feel free to. If you've got questions or something like that you want to message us, please go ahead and do it. Like, we love getting feedback, and we love hearing about, like, what, you know, if you're excited about something that we talked about, you want to hear more about it, please just let us know.
And if you disagree with us, we're okay with that too.
As long as you're polite about it.
As long as you're nice about it.
Yeah. We also, of course, are on various social medias. We are on Twitter at Citizen Dame Pod and Instagram at Citizen Dame Pod. And we are a Letterboxd HQ at Citizen Dame. And then, of course, you can also get in touch with us individually. Karen, where are you?
I am on all the socials, but especially Instagram and Letterboxd. And I'm kind of sorry, I'm dipping a little bit back into Twitter at Karen M. Peterson.
And I'm not tipping back into Twitter.
Don't do it. Don't do
I am on Instagram and Letterboxd at LH Business. My mental health can't handle Twitter.
No, don't do it. Don't do it.
I did not like myself when I was on Twitter, to be totally honest. So I'm not doing it again. And yes, I think that is going to close us out for this week.
Bye. I was like, are you going to say anything?
I threw myself off.
If you could have found out what that rosebud meant, I bet that would have explained everything.
No, I don't think so. No. Mr. Kane was a man who got everything he wanted and then lost it. Maybe rosebud was something he couldn't get or something he lost. Anyway, it wouldn't have explained anything. I don't think any word can explain a man's life. No, I guess rosebud is just a piece in a jigsaw puzzle. A missing piece. Well, come on, everybody. We'll miss the train.